This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
This is E.O. Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to the
Humanist Network
Humanist
News.
Network
Humanist
News.
Network News.
Humanist Network News.
I ain't afraid of your Yahweh. I ain't afraid of your Allah. I ain't afraid of your Jesus. I'm afraid of what you do in the name of your God.
It's February 27th, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Humanism, the topic of our show, is a worldview based on reason, compassion, and creativity. What do we have planned for today, Jess?
Well, Duncan, we're going to play an interview with the late Arthur Miller.
A very special treat.
Absolutely. But first, before we go any further, I feel the need to share with our listeners that I sit across from Duncan's closet, looking at his collared button-down shirts. I'm sitting next to his six, maybe, seasons of Seinfeld DVD collections.
Yeah, it's a little untidy here. I was, for you listeners, I was anticipating a big blizzard today here in Albany, where we produced the show, and brought the equipment home, convinced that I would bring you the show, snow or shine. And it's actually a beautiful day. There's no snow, but we are in my very untidy home office.
You said it, not me.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, well, I think we should talk about, before we get into Arthur Miller, we should tell folks about how we celebrated Darwin Day.
Absolutely.
This year, the Institute formally took over the Darwin Day celebration, an international program. And here in Albany, we hosted a legislative advocacy day, brought humanists from around the state to meet with legislators and urge them to base policy on sound science. How do you think it went, Jez?
Very successful. We had, what, about two dozen people?
Two dozen
here?
People, yeah. I sat in on three meetings with legislators. I had a blast. I just felt like I was taking part in the political process.
And this is the first time that humanism or humanists have actually done any sort of political lobbying, right?
It was the first event of this kind, as far as we know. And we're hoping to do more, not just here in New York State, but also around the country. And of course, the Secular Coalition for America is getting very active in Congress. Now, during the day, we also learned that our Darwin Day resolution passed unanimously in the state assembly. That was honoring Charles Darwin's 199th birthday anniversary. But it also urged it was a vow from legislators to keep basing policy on sound science so that New Yorkers can make informed decisions. So you can learn all about that on our website, humanistnetworknews.org.
We also got a great placement in the New York Times for this event, right?
Pretty big. Yeah, pretty big. It was an article. A columnist from the Times came up to Albany and followed Jennifer Lang, our lobbyist, around, making her rounds throughout the day. Hey, Jess, why don't you read like two paragraphs from that?
Ms. Lang's mission on this Monday in early February was to scuttle a bill titled the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which she and every legislator on her agenda called, in their common insider's slang, RFRA. Of the nearly 10,000 pieces of legislation introduced annually in the New York State Legislature, the act was one of only several dozen brought under the lead sponsorship of Assembly's Speaker, Sheldon Silver. It was not going to be an easy target. Then again, in her 10 months as the part-time registered lobbyist for the Institute for Humanist Studies, Ms. Lang had already reckoned the difficulty of her task. Alone in Albany and among just a few comparable figures elsewhere in the nation, she advocates for the political interest of secularists who variously describe themselves as non-believers, freethinkers, humanists, atheists, skeptics, and brights.
Well, I love the writing in this article. It's titled, On Religion, A Pragmatist and a Lobbyist on Atheism. It's written by Samuel G. Friedman, who is the author of several acclaimed books. He's a Columbia School of Journalism professor and a regular columnist for the New York Times.
Kudos to you, Duncan, on getting that placement, and kudos to Jen for doing such a wonderful job on that day.
Well, thanks a lot, Jess. Anyone else who wants to read this article, go to the New York Times website. Look for it. It ran on February 23rd. I'm the kind of guy who likes to read the newsprint version, so maybe check it out in your library if you're like me. Okay, Jess, well, last week I traveled down to Manhattan to meet with a new production company about a brand new film, but I introduced it when I was down there, so let's just cut to the tape.
I'm here with Richard Lorber, who is the CEO and president of Lorber HT Digital in Manhattan. And today is a very exciting day because Your latest project, The Atheism Tapes, just began shipping. Richard, can you tell our listeners briefly what The Atheism Tapes is all about?
Yes, I'm pleased to. The Atheism Tapes is a series of 6 half-hour interviews undertaken by the physician and philosopher and man of letters, Jonathan Miller, in preparation for a BBC series he did called A Brief History of Disbelief. The Atheism Tapes became the core source material for that more encompassing series and is really the radioactive kernel of his discussion and insights into the issues of atheism today.
I'm very excited you're offering this DVD for sale because the Institute for Humanist Studies, where I work, paid for the underwriting to bring Jonathan Miller's A Brief History of Disbelief to the American television. And I've been bombarded with phone calls from people asking where they can buy the DVD, which that DVD is not for sale. But this DVD series is now for sale. Tell us a little bit about Jonathan Miller. He's quite an extraordinary man with many different interests.
Well, he probably first became known to many people, those of us who go back in time a bit, as one of the founding members of Beyond the Fringe, which was a satirical comedy group out of London that became the almost the prototype for Monty Python and all the other forms of culturally rebellious humor and satire. His other members in Beyond the Fringe was Dudley Moore and several others, most of whom are either deceased or off doing other things. Miller himself is a medical doctor and in his own right a philosopher of sort and a social critic and a very interesting kind of polymath who has applied his inquisitive mind to many issues and continues to be involved in television productions and quality arts and cultural endeavors.
It's thrilling to watch Jonathan Miller himself, and it's doubly exciting to watch Jonathan Miller interview some of the amazing people he spoke to preparing for A Brief History of Disbelief. Can you tell me some of the names of the people who appeared in A Brief History of Disbelief who are now appearing in The Atheism Tapes?
Among the best known, certainly Richard Dawkins, who is an evolutionary biologist with a chair at, I believe, Oxford. In addition, Daniel Dennett, another prominent philosopher. Colin McGinn, also a British philosopher and a widely published author and well-known philosopher and social thinker. And in addition, in The Atheism Tapes is notably Arthur Miller. Arthur Miller is the great, you know, American playwright who sadly died a couple of years ago. This was one of the last interviews, if not the last interview produced with Miller participating. And that's one of the things that makes The Atheism Tapes most special.
Well, when I was watching A Brief History of Disbelief, you know, having the job I do, I'm familiar with a lot of the other faces that appear in the project. But really, I got very excited to see Arthur Miller on the screen and very excited to see a new voice added to this conversation. So we have a very special treat for our listeners today. We're going to play the audio courtesy of Lorber HT Digital and Alive Mind, which is the label for the DVD series. So Richard, can you introduce this segment for us?
Yes, the segment features Jonathan Miller interviewing Arthur Miller. We have Miller versus Miller here, not really versus. They're both on the more or less the same side. And what's most fascinating is the really personal nature of the conversation. Both of them come from very disparate backgrounds. Miller, Jonathan, more of an upper class British upbringing. Arthur Miller comes from a working class background in Brooklyn, and he talks about how he was a truck driver before he became a playwright. And but they both come to more or less the same conclusions, which have to do with basically why they don't hold a belief in a deity. And it's quite fascinating to see how they align their own thinking from such disparate backgrounds. And that will come through with great warmth and humor and insight in the interview you'll be hearing now.
Now, in his long professional life as one of America's most distinguished playwrights, Arthur Miller has brought warmth, wit, and intelligence to bear on the American scene. When I met him in his New York apartment, I asked him about his early life, about his attitude to Judaism and the extent to which he felt that there has grown up in our time a strange association in the Christian mind between Judaism and disbelief, the idea that there's something peculiar about the Jews which makes them peculiarly susceptible to profane disbelief.
Well, of course, the anti-Semitism goes under a thousand disguises, and one of them is certainly that the Jews are atheists at heart.
Of course, they don't believe in Christ, and that makes anybody, if not an atheist, then pretty close, a heathen, perhaps.
Mm. When you were a boy in Brooklyn, were you in an Orthodox or observing family?
They were observing two or three times a year. Apart from that, they were busy trying to live, make a living, and the rest of it. We were not. They were. If they were anything, they were observant or Orthodox. But that only occurred during the high holidays. The rest of the time, they were free to do whatever they wanted. They didn't go to synagogue every Saturday. They didn't pray. It was a kind of a obedient nod in the right direction.
But as a child of that type of family, which I suppose in some way was similar to mine, though it was perhaps less observant than the one you describe, did you yourself begin to differ from the Orthodox background from which you came?
Well, I tried to be a religious person when I was 12, 13, 14. It lasted about 2 years. And then it simply vanished. I simply laid down one evening to go to sleep and woke up the next day and it wasn't there anymore. And I guess it was part of my growing up that I would be searching for my roots somewhere. And I found them elsewhere. I didn't find them in religion, because religion, especially in the Depression 30s, seemed absolutely absurdly irrelevant. We were in the midst of a terrific social crisis here, and the religious in general had nothing to say about it.
But were there other reasons apart from the political irrelevance of religion? Did you have, as it were, other reasons, say, sort of rational reasons for thinking?
Of course, I no longer could believe. I quickly, at some point in my late teens, began reading and surmising that the idea of religion was a creation of man's longing to signify, to be a permanent part of the universe. And as I've grown older, I have to respect some of the religious people, because some of them, as you know, during the struggles we've had, have been terrific.
Mm.
And they've been motivated by religious principle in many cases. And therefore, I don't dismiss the whole thing by any means. But myself, personally, I don't have the talent to believe. That's the way I look at it. I simply haven't got... I keep seeing my grandfather instead of God. And it doesn't work anymore. But philosophically, if I can use that word, it just seems to me so patent that what man has done is to project himself into the heavens, where he can be all-powerful, as he's not here, and moral, and decent, and vengeful, and all the things he's not allowed to do on the earth, and to don that white garment and the beard and be what he wished in his dreams he could be.
And I can't get past that.
Hello, it's Elizabeth Sheldon, Vice President of Alive Mind and Editor of Secular Philosophy. You're listening to Humanist Network News. And now back to Jonathan Miller interviewing Arthur Miller from the Atheism Tapes.
These childhood memories prompted another thought about the extent to which religious skepticism amongst certain Jews was associated with left-wing sympathies. So I asked Arthur Miller if he thought that this supposed association had any part to play in the development of 20th century anti-Semitism.
There is an undoubtedly close relationship between Jews and the left, and also a sort of a trio of beliefs: disbelief in God, Judaism, and an affiliation with the very political movements which might have to be the ones which are recruited in order to bring about a solution to the problems that you've described. Yeah. Now, so why do you think, though, what is this relationship?
Well, for one thing, the Jews felt that was a different period than now in one respect. The anti-Semitism in the United States was rampant. It was open. For example, many people had to go to Europe to become doctors. Mm-hmm. They weren't admitted to Columbia University, to almost all American universities had a quota on Jews, and it was very small. There was the largest radio audience in the United States was for a man who was quoting Goebbels all the time.
This was Father Conlon. Mm.
He had the largest audience, excepting for FDR. He was saying how wonderfully the Nazis had dealt with unemployment, how fine it was that they were defending their racial purity. This from a Catholic priest. I remember walking down a street in Brooklyn one day, hot day in the middle of July, and all the windows were open. And I think it was on a Sunday afternoon. And from one house after another, you could hear that voice. And it was a sneering raucous. He was a real rabble-rouser. He blamed the Jews for the Depression. That was the fundamental thing, that the money lenders had been thrown out of the temple, but they were back in. And they controlled the currency. They controlled the big corporations. They controlled everything secretly. They were the secret demon underlying the troubles of the state. I was a worker in those days. I was out driving trucks and the rest of it. And you could cut it with a knife. It was brutal. And it was open. There was no question about it. So Jews were already positioned vis-a-vis the society as being, they weren't being killed. They were simply being gently and firmly kept out of the mainstream. No big corporation had Jewish executives. It was unheard of. So one understood what persecution might be, and therefore you were driven to the left, because the right was not interested in these problems, nor were most liberals. It was too dangerous. After all, a shipload of Jews from Germany arrived in New York Harbor and was not permitted to land. And these were not impoverished, desperate people. You know, these were middle-class people to have had the money to make this trip and to pick up all their stuff and move out of Germany. And they were sent back. It was called, the name of the ship was the St. Louis. And then they went from here to Cuba, where, from the studies I've read, the Americans did not want the Cuban government, which was then a dictatorship of the right, to let them in, lest it show up what we had done and reveal the cruelty of what we had done. Nobody was interested in confronting this thing. And they were sent back to Germany. I presume they were all killed.
Well, I remember talking to a Polish intellectual and him saying,
We can accept the idea that that Jesus was Jew, but what sticks in our throat is the idea that the Holy Mother was Jewish.
Oh, God. It's exhausting just to think about the where to begin to throw light on this whole thing. I wrote a play called The Creation of the World and Other Business, which is about Genesis. And I didn't mean to, but I got involved with the Bible in a way that I'd never had before. And it's very interesting that the old rabbis, whoever put the Bible together, which was obviously written by different people at different times in history, they could have chosen any book to start the Bible. It was no doubt, or the whole thing was lying on a table in front of them. Some editor had to say, this is the opener. And they opened with a fratricide. And the fratricide was there, I suppose, because that's the worst thing that can happen, is that two brothers, one of them is killed by the other brother. Because it doesn't involve the outsider.
And yet it does. You see, I remember reading, I don't know whether you ever saw this book by Ruth Mellenkoff, called The Outsider, and it's a collection of images in art history of the representation of these various figures in the Bible. And in the early years of the 16th century, Cain is Jewish, Abel is Gentile.
How did that happen?
Just the way in order to get round the problem of the fratricide, they had to somehow retrospectively identify the villainous Jew. It's quite extraordinary. In some of these early German pictures, you see this blonde Abel and this ringleted and bearded Cain.
I'll tell you a quick story. In the early 50s, I was traveling with a friend of mine in Foggia, because at the moment he was looking for an aunt he'd never met, who was a school teacher in the city of Foggia. And we found her, and he's Italian-American and Catholic. And she was curious to know what I was. And he said, he's Ebreo, he's Jewish. And she looked surprised. And he said, you know, the people in the Bible. She said, oh, yes. She says, well, as long as they believe in Christ. Of course, I suppose it's inevitable that, and will always be there to some degree, that one's own group, being most familiar, is less dangerous than an out-group, which is always menacing because it's strange. They look different. They don't speak the way we do. They break the boiled egg on the narrow end instead of the broad end. This is going to go on forever, but when politicians seize upon these differences or these apprehensions,
particularly the religious differences,
and when they make religious differences the center of the political program,
that's when the end is nigh.
Well, the end certainly felt a bit nigh when we met, as the war in Iraq was already well underway. So I asked Arthur why it was that skepticism is increasingly seen by many Americans as politically incorrect, as subversive, unacceptable, and, of course, unpatriotic.
I get the impression that from the vantage point of Europe,
for the last 18 months at least, and perhaps before, that atheism or disbelief or skepticism is seen by many Americans as politically incorrect, as subversive and unacceptable. Am I right in thinking that?
It's probably the case. They certainly the religious overlay of patriotism has come into fashion. It's always there, of course, in this country. More people go to church here than I think anywhere. But it's gotten heavier now. They invoke God at any opportunity, whether it's buying an automobile or...
Do you think is that since 9/11, or do you think...
It was always here, but it's gotten thicker. Gotten heavier because it's such an easy way to cuddle up to what they think the majority is about, which is this slavish kind of worship of something, and it's a political event.
But it is the first time for many years that you've had a government, a president.
Well, I don't recall it ever being the government itself doing this. It could have happened, but I'm not aware of it. I mean, I never heard of a government calling upon faith-based agencies taking care of the sick and the unemployed and the rest of it. Formerly, the government simply did these things as much as they ever did.
And one also gets the impression that the enterprise in Iraq had a sort of faith-based patriotism. It wasn't just patriotic,
right.
It was Christian patriotic.
Of course, in wartime, I suppose we did that in the Second World War to a degree, but it was never laid on with a trowel this way. I think Roosevelt called upon God occasionally, but it didn't bother him too much.
Did you ever get the impression that although he called upon God, which he might have done, as it were, nominally, but did he? Do you ever get the impression that he was, in fact, a Christian beyond the call of duty?
He was not using it. This is now being used as a means of persuasion. It's patent. It's obvious. They call upon God to initiate a program, whatever it may be, a civil program of some sort, and they lard it over with some religious verbiage to make it seem as though if you oppose this, you oppose the Lord. There are a lot of Americans, I think they're a minority, but they're very vocal, are really aching for an Ayatollah. I think they would love to have a Department of Religion. We go back to the early 17th century, perhaps, and have a church, an official church. But they've convinced a lot of people to forget that this country was founded by people who were really escaping the domination of a governmental religion. And... who breathe freely here with gratitude that they didn't have to obey a church government, churchly government.
But they then became as theocratic as the people that they left.
It seems to be something that has to be resisted on principle from one generation to another. At the moment, it's tougher than ever because the government itself is blatantly on the side of an official religion, I think. What is bothering me about the whole thing is that we're now more and more confronting a real issue in this country about the attempt of the religious, so-called religious, because I'm not sure they are religious. I think they're very nationalist people.
Mm-hmm.
And the wedding of Christianity or Judaism with nationalism is lethal. In my opinion, if you look at every violent conflict in the world now is being led by priests, rabbis, or Muslim clerics. It's quite amazing. I wonder whether it ever happened or whether it's happened in hundreds and hundreds of years. It's the church militant in all these religions. They've moved in, they've added that lethal mixture of religion and nationalism to the programs that they sell, and And the reason it's lethal is because to believe in a religion means that you don't believe in a different religion. Mm. You can't believe in two religions. You got to believe in one, and the other ones are wrong.
And often to be destroyed.
And deserve to be combated and destroyed. I mean, it's implicit in the whole idea of religious belief, I think, in the normal way that religious belief is thought of. You can't be both a Catholic and a Protestant.
Well, and now there seems to be this, what would previously have been almost inconceivable, this unholy alliance between fundamentalist evangelical Christians in the United States and Orthodox Jews,
yes,
who are combining to support these...
The Christian zealots believe that Christ will return when the Jews become Christians. This news is going to come with a shock to most of the Jews that will hear it. But that's the program, that Armageddon comes, at which point the Jews become believers in Christ, and Christ returns, and we're off to the races. It's pretty heady stuff.
And it's become particularly virulent in the last almost 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, it's a form of...
intellectual bankruptcy, which is, I think, it's taken over a lot of the political space.
Well, although he's considerably older than I am, I think it's fair to say that neither Arthur Miller nor myself could be described as spring chickens. So it seemed reasonable to ask him what he felt about the prospect of a life after death.
Everything I say, which is very skeptical, if not worse,
is conditioned by one thing, and that is we don't know where life started or how. Nobody really knows that. And death is the end of consciousness is the awesome mystery that anybody who's lived at all knows he has no answer to. The idea that that consciousness could vanish, be no more, is unacceptable. It simply cannot. I have no way of accepting this.
Well, now, in your refusal to accept it, are you tempted to assume that in some mysterious way that it continues after some sort of, as it were, vacation?
That's right.
That it will resume somewhere?
That's what I find myself hoping.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And then I think, well, it does continue in art. And that the artist finally leaves us with his consciousness.
So that your work will outlast you. But do you feel in any way, do you feel tempted to believe or hope that in addition to the work in which your memory will be preserved, that you yourself... in some alternative version, unembodied, will continue to exist and be conscious?
I no longer can contain that idea, no. But for others, for instance, my wife of 40 years died about a year and a half ago. And I'm surrounded by all her stuff of her life. And the idea that she's not here is still... defeats some impulse.
Yes.
To recreate her. But I know what that impulse is. It's simply the inability to accept this absurdity, that all that consciousness and all that beauty simply isn't there anymore.
And so, you don't, as obviously as believers do, Christians perhaps more than Jews, that there will be some sort of rendezvous.
No, this is beyond me. I don't have that at all. I don't believe it. I think, as I said, if there is memory, because what we're talking about is a form of remembrance, if there is that, it's in the deeds that one did or the art that one created or, in some cases, perhaps in the children. but no more.
So you can't, as I can't, make sense of the idea of a continuing consciousness which outlasts the death of the body, in which that consciousness would, as it were, identify itself.
Wouldn't it
as
be
being...
lovely?
Well, do you think it would be lovely?
Well, of course, there'd be so many of us. It'd be a rather crowded area. I think it'd be like the subway at 5 o'clock in the evening. You wouldn't. You'd wish you could get off, I think.
But in addition to, as it were, the population problem,
is the urge is always there. I think the urge to preserve this thing, and if you're not careful, I suppose you could venture into everlasting life. But as I said earlier, death is the ultimate perplexity, and particularly not the body so much as the consciousness, the ability to observe, to talk, to store up images, which is we spend 60, 70, whatever, many years accomplishing. And in a breeze, it blows away. I think we're stuck with the earth and with the lives we've got. And the immortality notion is simply past my capacity to really believe in. I never could figure out what we Jews believe about an afterlife. I have the feeling that it doesn't quite exist. It's a skeptical area.
Well, I'm always told by people who know or seem to know that it's not altogether different from a seminar at Columbia, that you in fact go to Moses, you enroll, and Moses teaches you to infinity the finer points of the law.
Which seems no way out of it.
And but it does. That seems like locking the stable door after the horse is bolted.
Well, Richard, that was amazing. It was a wonderful hearing Arthur Miller. It's thrilling to be able to listen to him. It's very painful to know that he is an American cultural treasure who is now lost. Tell me a little bit more about the Atheism tapes. This is a for-profit venture to sell videos about atheism. I want to ask you, is atheism a profitable topic these days?
Well, you know, it's hard to imagine atheism as a business enterprise, and we're not primarily just in the business of selling atheism. We believe very much in presenting a wide range of views dealing with secular look at so-called spirituality and trying to bridge the distinctions between the belief in some higher being and a much more skeptical view based on rational understanding of the way the world is and understanding the factual base of natural phenomena based upon, you know, scientific inquiry. I think the thing that prompts us to take on this mission, if not mantle, is the politicization of religion in recent years. I think there's been more abuse and social injustice and crimes committed in the name of religion based upon the divisiveness of belief in recent years than we've seen in many years before. Of course, there's a history of divisiveness and abuse throughout history, whether you go back to an Inquisition or the pogroms or whatever you have. But today, for the first time, atheists seem to be coming out of the closet. And that in itself is a politicization of the movement, which in part has been a response to the rise of religious fundamentalism and fanaticism in all corners of the earth. And so today, there are people who have had unformed views about their own beliefs who are now beginning to take a position. And they're straightening their spines and saying, you know what, I'm not going to be coerced into an obedience and obeisance in terms of a religious environment when I can't really identify my own source of belief and commitments. And maybe I really have to come out and say for myself that I don't believe. And then the question remains, how do you characterize the moral and ethical character fiber of people who are disbelievers or non-theists? And so there's a positive aspect of atheism, which is to try to identify the values and the meanings that people who don't have a higher being to identify with as productive members of society and humane and compassionate and creative and imaginative, even if there's no aspiration to an afterlife. So it raises lots of questions. The fact that it's become perceived as a profitable enterprise is just a circumstance. The fact that Dawkins and Hitchens and others have written books that have suddenly become bestsellers is not anything that they would have expected. In fact, in an interview recently with Dawkins, he was told by his publisher when he presented the book, which was The God Delusion, some years ago, the publisher said, this is not the time to publish this. And they put it on the shelf for some time, for several years. When they finally did publish it, most recently, it went to the top of the charts. So it's really a circumstance of the zeitgeist and of the context and of this politicization of religion that's going on in the world. And there have been other times in history. I'm not a historian per se, but you can sure find other times where there's been an upsurge of this, which is in some ways a rebellion against the excesses and abuses of religion.
But do you also see a project like the Atheism Tapes and books like The God Delusion running parallel to the very profitable, very popular, you know, Christian literature, Christian movies, Christian movement? Did you see this as a pit?
Absolutely. And I think this is the counterforce and the counterweight. The fact that even in the United States, of course, we now live in a government which has basically embraced Christianity as the cause celeb or religion overall. And many of the policies are being advanced against the more progressive views in the interests of achieving the divine teachings of some higher being. I think it's not a surprise that there's this kind of – I wouldn't call it a backlash. I think it's just an important core response to these excesses.
Richard, what are some of your favorite moments throughout the Atheism Tapes?
Well, I certainly like the moments where you watch Jonathan Miller – suddenly go very quiet and looks into the eyes, whether it's Colin McGinn or Arthur Miller or Dawkins, and you can just hear the brain cells firing. I can't cite it as specific comments that are being made, but the fact is that you're watching and listening to extremely intelligent and extremely articulate people thinking on their feet. It has a humanity about it and an integrity that you rarely see in your typical interview program, particularly because you're dealing with such powerful ideas and important subjects.
For those who have seen Miller's A Brief History of Disbelief, how do the Atheism Tapes, in a sense, tell a different story? Because it is a slightly different story, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, the beauty of the Atheism Tapes is that it allows the viewer to come to their own conclusions. The History of Disbelief took this primary source material that Miller has effectively collected through the field, so to speak, field interviews, as though he were an anthropologist in the fields, like an Alan Lomax or someone doing interviews with, you know, great blues musicians or whatever. He went to the source. He interviews these thinkers and cultural figures in their homes and assembles the stuff. In Brief History of Disbelief, he did a wonderful job of putting it together and giving his own personal story and putting his own spin on it in a constructive sense. But in the Atheism Tapes, you have the pure, raw source material, and you have a chance to engage the conversations in your own way and, in effect, invent your own version of History of Disbelief.
Where can people purchase the Atheism Tapes who are listening now?
Well, we don't want to be thought of as a commercial venture, but we'd be very happy if our listeners did choose, and I think it would be a great collection to anyone's library. You can go to two places. One, secularphilosophy.com, which is a website we've set up to create a blogging community of people who are interested in the subject, dealing with issues of non-theism and atheism and a history of disbelief, secularphilosophy.com. Or you can go directly to our parent site, which is alivemindmedia.com. Both of those sites will direct you to the Atheism Tapes.
And on both of those sites, you have some constantly updated blogs by some of the big names in the movement. Who are some of the people blogging for you right now?
Right now we have for secular in our secularphilosophy.com, which we created specifically to become the context for the presentation of the atheism tapes and some other notable programs that we'll be releasing soon. We have Colin McGinn as our principal blogger. We have Daniel Dennett, both of whom are featured in the atheism tapes. And we have several other philosophers. I'll let our viewers discover them, but the most important ones right now related to the atheism tapes are Dennett and McGinn.
Well, Richard Lorber, it's been a pleasure meeting with you and listening to the interview with Arthur Miller and Jonathan Miller. Thanks a lot for inviting us into your offices and sharing this information.
Pleasure to meet with you and share these moments with your listeners, Duncan.
We're back in Duncan's oversized laundry hamper in Duncan's in-home recording studio. You're listening to Humanist Network News. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
I'm your host, Duncan Crary, taking some abuse this week from Jess.
Well-deserved abuse, Duncan.
So, Arthur Miller, I really enjoyed listening to that that interview with Arthur Miller. Did you read any of Miller's plays in high school or anything like that?
Yeah, of course I read The Crucible, which 5 minutes ago I called The Crucible.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that might be a local dialect or something. No, also you said Winona Ryder was in some movie
that you
saw?
Yep.
All right, I never saw that. I was just recently reading An Enemy of the People, which is Miller's Americanization or adaptation of, I think, Ibsen's play. But he deals with these universal themes. Like when you're reading a Miller play, it's still very fresh today.
Timeless.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, how can people buy the video from which we just heard that interview with Arthur Miller, Jess?
If you visit secularphilosophy.com, you can purchase the atheism tapes using a special coupon code.
Mm, just for you HNN listeners out there.
And that code is capital HMAT1210.
All right. And while you're online, you can also visit alivemindmedia.com, which is the website for the production company that put out the atheism tapes. You'll see that they have a lot of great blogs by some very recognizable intellectuals, including two rascals who snuck through the door. Jess and I are also featured there. You can listen to our podcast among their other materials.
Now, the atheism tapes are basically a longer footage of interviews featured in the documentary.
A Brief History of Disbelief. That's right. Several months ago, the Institute for Humanist Studies joined many other national humanist and freethought organizations to pay for the underwriting for the American broadcast of Jonathan Miller's A Brief History of Disbelief. That program originally aired on the BBC. We brought it to America. Yes, the interviews in the atheism tapes are like the raw footage from all the interviews Jonathan Miller recorded for A Brief History of Disbelief.
Right.
A lot of people wanted to buy... They asked me if they could buy DVDs of A Brief History of Disbelief, but they're not for sale right now due to some of the rights of the footage in there. But your next best bet is the atheism tapes. And I just wanted to give a little report from our friends at the Independent Production Fund who helped us get Miller's program broadcast in America. They were happy to report yesterday that A Brief History of Disbelief aired in 90 markets across the country. It reached 70% of households in the U.S. with televisions. It aired in 18 of the top 25 markets, including the top 6 markets. So the Institute and many other friends helped bring this important programming to a new audience.
We've got a couple of great listener comments, so let's play those.
Hi, Jess and Duncan. My name is Ian McDaniel, and I'm calling from Boise, Idaho. And I just wanted to say that your last 4 or 5 shows have been your absolute best. You've conducted some great interviews with great people and explored what I thought was some really interesting topics. They've been a real source of contemplation for me, and an even better source of discussion for my family and friends. And I have to say, though, that I'm missing Jess's Break On Through segment, so I hope that you'll consider more of those in the future. Those were really good. Also, I wanted to say that the discussion with Dr. Seltzer was really the high point for me of these recent shows. It's just really, I guess, inspiring to me that one person can be so accomplished in so many ways. And I thought Dr. Seltzer summed it up really well at the end of the interview when Duncan had said that he was an amazing man. Dr. Seltzer, that is, and not Duncan. Although I'm sure Duncan is an amazing guy, too. But Dr. Seltzer responded that he wasn't amazing, just an ordinary person who had done the best that he could. And to me, personally, that's a lot of what humanism is, giving credit where credit is due. It always makes me a little bit sad when I see somebody thanking God for their Academy Award or for their touchdown or for any accomplishment. I feel that to thank God for these things does an injustice and a real dishonor to what really got those people to where they are or allowed them to accomplish whatever it is that they accomplished. And I mean human ingenuity and human persistence. You know, that's what got them what they have. So I guess well done, Dr. Seltzer, and well done, Jess and Duncan. Well done, HNN. Keep up the good work, and thanks for the inspiration. Bye.
Well, thank you, Ian, for your feedback.
Yeah, Ian always has great comments.
Yeah, I'm sure he does. Duncan's a wonderful man.
I'm an amazing man. I am.
We actually do hope to be producing some more Break On Through segments, including your Eating with the Opposition piece. We haven't forgotten about you. Duncan and I have just been sort of
running around
busy.
Like mad.
Yeah.
We also plan to interview some women.
Yeah.
In future shows. It's just we have a lot of interviews scheduled with women. It's just that the way it's been, the men have been really, they've been talking a lot lately.
They have. We'll balance it out, though.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's hear our next comment.
Hi. My name is Hugh Giblin. Calling you from Durham, North Carolina. I listen to your podcast regularly and appreciate it. I thought your recent run on Dr. Seltzer was very moving, and he struck me as a fine person, a very, very thoughtful human being. I have a thought for a future show. I recently authored an article that's going to be published in the scholarly journal in the American Humanist Association called Essays in the Philosophy of Humanism. And in it, I'm advancing the idea of an American humanist political party. And in the article, I'm arguing that it might be a viable approach to making humanism a part of mainstream America, as opposed to the rather marginal group that we are right now. Organized humanism from the two major organizations in the country only total 10,000 folks, as opposed to something like 234 million Christians. In any event, I thought that because of the upcoming political intensity that we're going to experience this year, that might be a timely topic. And thanks for your good show. Bye-bye.
Well, thanks, Hugh. That's a great idea. And stay in touch, and maybe we can produce a segment like that in the future.
If you'd like to leave us a listener comment, please do so by calling our toll-free listener comment line, 877-659-1515.
I think that wraps it up for this month's show.
I think so.
To download episodes and read transcripts anytime, visit humaniststudies.org/podcast.
You can also learn about all of the music that we've played on our shows at humaniststudies.org/podcast.
Don't forget to check out our weekly e-zine on the weeks when you're just waiting for the next podcast at humanistnetworknews.org.
I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.
Humanist Network News is an audio production of the Institute for Humanist Studies, a nonprofit think tank that promotes the philosophy of humanism. Learn more at humaniststudies.org.